Good evening to all of you. I am really, really happy and delighted to be back with the NIPA fraternity. I am seeing so many NIPA people for so long time after decades. Even when I visit NIPA, I very rarely get a chance to see all of them. I could see only those who are there at that point of time. And thank you very much for this invitation, and thank you for organizing a meeting like this. We are used to attend meetings where gray-haired people outnumber black-haired people. But now this is the situation where the rules are all in the reverse side, and I am very happy about it. Although my hair is half gray, but people are so thankful. Yesterday, Tilak was asking me, what are you going to speak on? So I told him that I'm going to speak on two things. I'm going to speak on expanding higher education with equity, but I assure you that I will not speak anything which you do not know. This is the first assurance that I would like to make to follow. And with these two professorial comments, let me start my presentation. First thing, if you notice any or read any newspaper or economist or any other journal, what you normally find is that income levels have gone up. This is a global phenomenon. That's a very positive development. What you also notice is that inequalities in income have increased, and those who are more interested in knowing the specificities, if you apply the Gini coefficient, you will find that, or measurement, you will find that inequalities are substantially gone up, 0.66 to 0.6, and you will find that this has gone up in most of the important major economies. Then if one looks at some of the reasons, one of the reasons that is suggested is that it is the differences in the variations in the cognitive skill distribution that is one of the important factors responsible for the changes in the distribution of income or increasing inequalities. And if you read the latest Economist, there is an article called The Rich and the West. It's a very nice title, you know. We'll find a similar argument that is being developed. Now, what I mean to say is that I was looking at education development in different countries. One trend that I can very clearly discern or very clearly delineate is that limited access to higher education and inequalities in income, they go together. I'm not putting a causality argument here, but there is certainly a correlation analysis that can be done, a correlation statement that can be done very confidently. And if you look at the whole of African countries, where higher education is developed for GER, if I can use that word, as gross enrollment ratio in this house, what I find is that inequalities are much higher than those countries which are developed where the gross enrollment ratios are much higher, 50% or 60%, where it is multiplied or going to the level of universalization of higher education. A second trend that again I find is that inequality in higher education is seen as one of the reasons for these inequalities. Inequalities in the distribution of facilities for access to higher education. Previously, we were thinking about access to primary education, then we were thinking about access to secondary education. Now it is also emerging that inequalities in access to higher education emerging as an important factor. Now, when we look at inequalities in access to higher education, there are two issues that needs to be seen. Quite a lot of discussions took place in the last 2 days. One, role of higher education in production, and role of higher education in terms of public good, which can be a national public good or a global public good. So when you talk about role of higher education in production, we use all types of discussions that we had, the rate of return analysis, the market forces, the limited role of the state, etc., in promoting higher education, and also the role of the private sector. And if you come to the question of public good, whether it is national or international public good, actually there is nothing called national public good, I have used the word. So when it is a global public good, what we find is that markets have imperfections to supply the service and the goods in as much quantity as it is needed. Or in other words, there will be under supply of the service if you are relying only on the market, and market forces cannot be relied. And this is one of the reasons why some people argue against giving or leaving the sector for market forces or higher education or education sector in general. Now let me take, there is a trend and there is a belief that expansion of higher education leads to decline in inequalities or improving the equity situation. This is partially true, but not always. An expansion of higher education without any affirmative action need not necessarily lead to declines in the inter-class variation. Now there is a theory called maximally maintained inequality, and many of you may be knowing that. It's after the theory, based on the 20 country studies, which has come to the conclusion that there is something called a point of saturation when you talk about and the expansion of education, whether it is higher education or secondary education or primary education. But primary education is almost that stage of application that theory is over. It states that when a system which is very limited in access, when it expands, it is a privileged section which takes advantage of that expansion process. And you find that a saturation point when there are no many people from that segment or section take advantage of the facilities of expansion, then only it will percolate down to other levels. So you can find a situation that expansion takes place, there may not be substantial decline or substantial reduction in the inequalities. The inequality situation may continue. There can be three situations when you compare this. One is that expansion is taking place, but inequalities are increasing, which means that this expansion is helping only the elite group or the better of sections of society. There can be a situation where expansion takes place, but this inequality is stable over a period of time. That's the time we say that the expansion is benefiting both the groups. The real situation where expansion is helping the poor comes at a stage where you find that expansion is taking place, but at the same time, the inequality ratio is declining. That's the stage we have. Either we can wait till higher education reaches a 50% gross enrollment ratio or a 60% gross enrollment ratio, or we can have affirmative action in the beginning to see that this expansion is with the equity. And the only group which is benefited is the expansion where gender parity is attained even without any affirmative action. This is an interesting point that I like to develop 2 minutes on. What we find is that gender parity index, if you calculate, if it is at the primary level, then until the enrollment reaches 80 or 85 or 90%, you do not reach gender parity index. You see the NIPA publication, which are religiously brought out. So it's around, I hope.
Yeah, no, yes,
that's already. So you find that, and he has given gender parity index in all the states. You will find that in most of the states, except to Goa and Kerala and perhaps Punjab too, gender parity index is less than 192. But in higher education, what happens is that I have a pet hypothesis. Internationally, what one finds is that once the gross enrollment ratio reaches around 25%, you reach gender parity index, 25 to 30, if I can be generalized. And if you go beyond that, 35, 40, etc., then what happens is that there will be the GER of girls or GER of women surpasses men and substantially. In my paper, if you see, I have given examples where you find that GER of men is only 56% in some countries and GER of women is around 70%, 80%, etc. In other words, there are 2 levels of inequality that you find at the lower levels of enrollment in higher education. When it's a lower level, it means less than 10%, 12%, etc., where the system is not maxified. What one finds is that there is inequality between men and women, and this time the inequality is in favor of men and against women. On the other hand, when you expand the system to 20-25%, what one finds is that there is inequality again between men and women, but this time the inequality is in favor of women. GR of women are much higher than that of men. I do not know. I don't have, I have tried to provide some explanation, but I don't have explanation. But this is something that's a very important thing to see, especially those who are working on gender issues. If you come to India, and if you look at the data here, you find that gender parity index is 1 or 1.02, etc. If you look at Kerala and Goa, and perhaps Punjab too. But in all other states, you will find that gender parity index is much bigger. And if you take the educationally backward states of India, you will find that they belong to the first category, whereby you find that women are in a disadvantageous position. Whereas in other states where you find that the gross enrollment ratio is reached 20% in higher education, you find that this is the parity index is positive. But in other words, what I am saying is that India shows a case where the gender parity index in higher education is perhaps reached much faster than the gender parity index is reached internationally. And I tend to argue that some of our post discrimination policies are substantially contributed to this change. Now, a second question that I like to pick up is on the issue of diversification and equity. We have a notion, or many people, that expanding higher education means give the same type of education to everybody, the same type of university education. But that stage is over now. There are expansion and diversification are going hand in hand, and the systems which are expanded are also the systems which are diversified, or the systems which are diversified are also the systems which have expanded. And there are very few systems in the world, except Italy, where you find that there is diversity expansion that is taking place substantially without much diversification. Now the question comes, there are studies which show that diversification is a process of diversion. Diversion of the poor students from the good elite, academic-oriented, and research-based education to what you saw as hands-on touches, and finally they end up in jobs. I'm not sure whether this leads to long-term equity in society or long-term inequality in society. Now the question is that if you do not diversify and you do not expand, this is one implication, who are the beneficiaries. But if you expand and diversify, and if diversification is also a process of diversion of students or better of students, like the social stratification, you bring the condition, you take better of students to academic streams and prestigious universities, research universities, others to other streams, then there is something that is to be worked out. Perhaps it may not be possible for us to work out a system when the system was elite and when the enrollment ratios were less than 5% to talk about everybody getting the same type of education. But people are getting different types of education, but also try to see that more than equality, the notion of equity needs to be maintained. This is also related to the issue of quality. At times people say that one has, the elite, some people want to maintain the elite system. And the professorate in many societies were against expanding the system. I'm not saying that they were against equity considerations, but they felt that if the system is expanded, the quality will be diluted. But my argument is that if you look again empirically, there is no guarantee that less expanded system is qualitatively better than more expanded system. Again, I'll go back to Africa and to South Asia or to some other countries in the CIS region or to Latin America. I cannot say that university degrees that you get from Africa or South Asia are of higher quality than the university degrees that you get from Western countries, etc. So I think this is a misplaced argument, misleading the policymakers, and giving this as an argument to the people who are seeking higher education that we cannot expand higher education because if you expand, you have to accept low quality education. Similarly, the reverse of the case is that highly expanded systems, if you look at the university rankings, and if you take the first 100 rankings, first 100 out of that, at least 45 to 50 universities which are ranked high come from the United States itself. And if you ask Britain and some of the European countries, you'll find that nearly 60% to 65% of the top-ranking universities belong to this. I'm not saying that I subscribe to the university ranking, but I cannot say that the top-ranking universities in the ranking are universities which do not provide quality education. So therefore, I have a question mark there. How, to what extent we can use restriction of access to higher education as an argument for maintaining or improving quality? I do not subscribe to this issue. But at the same time, today when we talk about expansion of higher education, we are not talking about expansion of higher education through the public system. The two changes that are taking place in the expansion of higher education are, one, most of the expansion that is taking place today is through non-state funding. I'm not saying that private sector. Listen, I'll come to it at a later stage. Non-state funding. Second one, it has taken place because of the largest number of women joining the education sector. These are the two factors that are done. And if you look at the providers, there's a multiplicity of providers. Private sectors, you'll find that the cross-national, cross-border service providers, and also you find that distance education providers, and there are so many. Now, when the state was providing education, when there was a unitary system of higher education that was existing, it was easy to regulate some, regulate quality, it was easy to talk about whatever we say is quality. But when you find that, which is not the case, multiple providers are there, the education quality becomes an issue. That is why you find accreditation agencies, national accreditation agencies, etc., come up in most of the countries. So the argument is that the external quality assurance mechanism and quality assurance mechanisms within the institutions to be strengthened rather than curbing, putting a curb on the expansion. Now, just on issue related to some of the strategies for equity, you find that I have given a list of countries, at least 50 countries, experiences in one of the tables there. You find that affirmation policies in admission is very common, but not at the time of grading the student or awarding the mark. What you also find that diversification, as I mentioned, in almost all the countries except very few. You will also find that additional funding is used as an important mechanism trying to see that it can be either to the student or to the institutions or to create an environment. You will find that if it's the inequality between regions, it is easy to start an institution in that region. But when the inequalities are between groups, it is very difficult to locate them in one place and start an institution separately for them. And I do not agree with such strategies, although some countries have started, like Australia and New Zealand, etc. Because when you start a new institution entirely for the desired group, you are also socializing them with those people within that group, which I don't think is very good, because socialization is one of the important elements in higher education, in whole of education, and especially in higher education. You know, a person is known by the company he keeps. You know, what happens is that normally the many of the things that we pick up need not be directly from the teacher, especially in higher education, from the peer groups and also from the discussions that that take place and also from the library. The last part of my presentation is, now the question comes, if equity is what we want to derive, if state should be there or market should be there, and what are their relative roles in education? You know that this question was irrelevant 30 years ago, because most part of the world, except in countries such as Korea or Philippines or Indonesia or some countries in Latin America, you will find that higher education was provided by the state, and states have almost a monopoly in the provision of higher education in most of the countries. But today, this is not the case. The markets are not. People expected that markets will be coming to mature capitalist countries. Markets will be coming to higher education in mature capitalist countries, but that is not the way it has happened. Markets have come to the least developed countries in higher education. That is a very important and significant finding. Why it is very important and significant finding is that you find in Africa today larger number of private higher education institutions than you find in Britain or in France or in Germany or in Netherlands or in Sweden or in Finland or in Norway or Portugal. So why it is happening? It's happening because the state, the fiscal capacity of the state has declined, and then the option is that either you expand the system or you deny the opportunity. Now, there are two types of changes that are taking place. One, what I like to call as privatization, where the public institutions are run based on the market principle, charging fees like our IIMs, etc. The heavy fees are charged, I'm not talking about the capitation fee for this, I'm talking about the other side. You find that market principles are applied, but it's almost like a full cost recovery. Then you have the private institution, which is not public in any way, they award the degrees and they levy the fees. Now the option for the student, you have to pay the fees if you go to the public institution, you have to pay the fees if you go to the private institution. So you have a choice. If the education is good, you perceive that quality is good in private institution, you go there. If you consider that this is better in public institution, you go there. But the reality is that most of the private institutions, except a few, are running what is called as market-friendly courses. They are catering to the market. One of the arguments can be that when higher education was funded by the public sector, when it was expanding, the products of the higher education sector was also utilized by the public sector because the employment opportunities were largely growing in that sector. Now the question is that now the situation has changed. The market has expanded its sector of activity, and the employment opportunities in the private sector and market sector are expanding much more than the employment opportunities expanding in the public sector. Under such situation, should the state continue with the same type of funding formula that existed 30 years ago, 40 years ago, or there is a change in the funding formula or funding pattern that is relied by the state? So in the name of, but the immediate situation is that whether it is primary education or higher education, when the system initially expanded, the rich took advantage of the system, but at that time, public funded it. Even in higher education, now when the system was 5% expanding, it was totally funded by the state. Now the poor people are coming to the system and then we are saying that we have to pay for it. I don't know whether it is equity system or individual system. The other alternative is that you do not expand the system, maintain a state system, but you do not get the opportunity. I can cite examples from universities after universities in many countries and say that if in CIS countries, sometimes referred to as what is referred to as budget students, which means the students who are sponsored by the government, and non-budget students who pay fees. And in many places, expansion takes place the non-budget students. Similarly, you find that in African context, you find that what is called as sponsored students and non-sponsored students, the expansion takes place in the non-sponsored students. So if you look at the case studies of many different institutions, will show that it is the private student sector which is expanding much faster than the government-sponsored ones. So there is a question. Second type of equity question should be limited. Should we expand the system? Should we restrain the system, rely on the public sector? Or should we expand the system by relying on the market forces? And that makes a difficult choice that is to be made. And this choice is essentially a political choice that is to be made. But my feeling is that no system which is not regulated is not a good system today. People are coming back to the state. You know, actually the crisis was good in one sense. Don't quote me outside. It's good in one sense. What has happened is that, say for example, Alan Greenspan was perhaps one of the unquestionable leader god or economic person, economic god, and if he makes one statement in one meeting, in press conference in Washington, the New York Sensex will be going up by 10 points or going down by 10 points, you know. So he was appointed in 1984. Reagan maintained him, George Bush maintained him. After that, Clinton maintained him, everybody maintained him. But today, he is not such a respected figure. Why? The crisis has shown that an unregulated system has created a crisis which has become a liability, not only for the private sector, but also for the public sector and for every millions of people who are pushed below the poverty line as a result of the crisis and who is responsible for this. So we are coming back to regulation. Again, about globalization, if you see some of the slogans that you find during the economic crisis in many countries, we also find that anti-globalization slogans are fine. So therefore, there is a need for regulation, for unregulated growth of markets becomes a point or it reaches a field of crisis. And therefore, I am for more state-regulated systems. And my last point is that the
there are many options that can be made. Say, we cannot say, now economic growth rate is going up in many countries, especially India and China. And in this millennium, there is no country, I should not use the word name, in no country, even in the most backward countries, in economically backward countries in Africa, you find that the growth rate was 4 to 5%. So therefore, in an expanding system, even if you maintain the same percentage, it is you can fly more facilities. But when the system is expanding, if you believe in human capital or in human development, there is an argument to invest more, which can improve, augment the resources. And finally, when the state is spending, in the name of the poor, the rich need not have to get subsidies always. The state has strategies to target the subsidies more focused on the poor, while the rich who can afford it can be permitted to pay for it. We should not have a system where the rich prosper in the name of the poor and subsidies continue in the name of the poor. At the same time, the subsidies are taken advantage by the rich. Thank you.